Morning. Welcome. I'm very glad that you're here. In 1972, a book came out with a very descriptive title. I think you can identify with it. Alexander and the Terrible, Horrible, No Good, Very Bad Day. 1972 is when the book came out. It was meant to be a children's book, but it seemed to apply to a bunch of adults, didn't it? It's now a movie. It came out in 2014. Alexander's day begins with gum in his hair, and then it goes downhill from there. And he thinks he's the only guy that has bad things happening to him. He tries to get help from his family, but his family is also having this horrible day. And so he's kind of on his own. Have you been there recently? Like, this is the worst day ever. This is the fourth in the series of messages called Get Back Up. And we've been talking about these horrible days, depressing times in our lives, how to respond, how to get back up from that. And it's really cool because we've seen some of the best known men in the Bible suffer through these depressing times, this series of depressing days. Guys like Elijah and Solomon and David, to name a few. We've seen how God has worked with them and been with them in the darkness. And so today I want to nominate for you another man who had, I think, the most terrible, horrible, no good, very bad day ever in the history of days. And that, of course, would be Job, right? Not you, it would be Job. So I want to read for you the first part of chapter 1 just to tell you about his horrible day. Are you ready? You can follow along or check it out behind me. One day when Job's sons and daughters were feasting and drinking wine at the oldest brother's house, a messenger came to Job and said the oxen were plowing and the donkeys were grazing nearby, and the Sabians attacked and made off with them. They put the servants to the sword, and I am the only one who has escaped to tell you. While he was still speaking, another messenger came and said, the fire of God fell from the heavens and burned up the sheep and the servants, and I am the only one who has escaped to tell you. While he was still speaking, another messenger came and said, the Chaldeans formed three raiding parties and swooped down on your camels and made off with them. They put the servants to the sword, and I am the only one who has escaped to tell you. While he was still speaking, yet another messenger came and said, your sons and daughters were feasting and drinking wine at the oldest brother's house when suddenly a mighty wind swept in from the desert and struck the four corners of the house. It collapsed on them and they are dead, and I am the only one who has escaped to tell you. That is a terrible, horrible, horrible, no good, very bad day. Our city of Buffalo is depressed every Monday in the fall after the Bills lose a game. It's like there's a cloud over our area. It's like the efficiency at work is like in slow motion. What's wrong with people? I don't know. But that's nothing like Job's day at all, is it? He lost all of his possessions and property, his source of income, his transportation, his business, and oh yeah, 10 children all in one day. And then chapter 2 describes a day a lot like the first one, only this time the guns of Satan are turned on Job's health, his body, and Job is in a mess physically. His wife and his servants, a few of them, that's all he has left. And then Job's friends come to comfort him. And when they look at him from a distance, they can hardly recognize him. Sometimes you might walk into a hospital room and you think you know somebody, but they're in such a mess. They've got tubes and bandages, and you're going, is that really them? And that's what his friends must have thought. Now, Job's friends get plenty of criticism for their counsel of Job. But that's not going to happen here today very much. It's important to recognize that Job's friends showed up. That's what friends do. You may not know what to say when trouble happens to one of your friends, but it is always important to show up and just be there. Many of you remember October 2006 when the surprise snowstorm hit our region and many, many people lost power for several days in a row. Deb and I were among that group. And it was just really cool how people started looking in on each other during that time. One family who lived not even a mile from us, their whole neighborhood had power, but somehow we didn't. And they had a generator. So they loaned us a generator, which we tried to share with other people as well. And it was just a real blessing. And one man and his daughter stopped by on a dark night when before we had power. They brought some refreshments. They just brought some encouragement to check on us. We talked by candlelight. Todd, thank you for being that guy that day for us. And it's a kindness that's etched into the memory of people. You just don't remember what was said. You just remember, man, that was really cool that they came and did that. So when suffering hits somebody, when this depressive stuff happens, I just would encourage you to show up. Don't think somebody else is going to do that. God put it on your heart. You should be the one that goes and does that. And people will not remember your words. They'll just remember that you cared enough to show up. Pain is a common language in our world, and every culture understands it. I mean, you can go anywhere. Every culture understands that the loss of a child is devastating, or the failure of the economy is excruciating, or natural disaster is confusing. And a lot of times, we're that guy who wants to outdo the trouble of the person who's hurting. You know, like you could say, well, man, I was driving yesterday and I was T-boned by an 18-wheeler. And I broke my back in three places and my car was totaled. And your friend will say, well, man, that stinks. But that reminds me of the time when I wrecked my bike when I was 7 and I sprained my wrist. You know, that kind of, I'm trying to outdo you. I've got a better story than you. I can do better than that. But that wasn't very helpful for Job. And that won't be very helpful for your depressed friends either. Job's friends stayed silent for 7 days. Try that. But they were communicating, weren't they? This is horrible. We're with you. My friend Pat lost her husband 18 months ago, and she's been trying to figure out what to do with their big house since then. And the real estate agent called her in the spring and said, this would be a good time to put your house on the market. Things are moving. And suddenly Pat received an offer she couldn't refuse. So now it means finding a new place. And they've lived there for over 30 years. It's the only home that the grandchildren have ever known. That's the place of Nanny and Papa. And that's where we go to meet them. And so this week was her last week in that home. And she said she wandered from room to room just in tears. Every door she went through reminded her of some great memory, some event that took place there. And then it was time to actually physically turn over the keys. And she said it was excruciating. I mean, she was a basket case. What do you say? You say, you know what? I have moved 7 times in my life and it's no big deal. You'll get over it. Or you'll get used to that new place really soon. It'll be good for you to get a fresh start and get away from all those memories. Well, that is probably helpful advice for somebody somewhere, but at this moment in time with this person, that's inappropriate words, right? You need to come up with something else. It's a milestone week in her life. What do you do? What do you say? I saw her post online and I knew, I mean, it was on my heart. I had to do something. I just called her up and I had 2 lines. I just said, I'm thinking about you this week. How's it going?
That's all I did.
And you would have thought I was the smartest counselor that ever walked on the face of the earth. I just opened up the door and she started talking and telling me all this stuff. I would say to you, like Job, it is okay to be completely honest with God and just say sometimes life stinks. It just stinks. And all you can do is say, I am sorry for you and I'm here with you and I don't know how to fix it, but I'm here. Eugene Peterson made this amazing quote in his translation of the book of Job called The Message. He said, suffering attracts fixers the way roadkill attracts vultures. Think about that for a minute. Job's friends had very good intentions, didn't they? They wanted to explain what was wrong and then tried to fix the damage. Their intentions were good. We've all done that. I mean, probably each one of us in the room are guilty of saying these things. They're all true things. They're just things that are said maybe at the wrong time to the wrong person in the wrong place. We say, well, God works all things together for good to those who love the Lord and call according to his purpose. And Job might be saying, really? I don't think so. Or you might say, God must be trying to teach you a lesson here. Or you need to fess up about that hidden sin in your life. You're probably doing something you just haven't. I mean, if you get rid of that, if you express it to God, he'll make things better. Sometimes we say, you know what, you're outside of God's umbrella. If you come back under his will, under his umbrella, you'll receive his blessing. Or you need to pray harder and have deeper faith. Again, those things are appropriate to say at some point in time, but in Job's case, none of those things were right. They were all incorrect. Suffering attracts fixers like roadkill attracts vultures. Wow. So when your friends are hurting, go. Come alongside them. Ask simple questions. Listen carefully. Then when you leave, just say, I got no answers, but I'm praying God's peace on your life. That's simple. And it works. Proverbs 25:10 says, like one who takes away a garment on a cold day, or like vinegar poured on soda, is one who sings songs to a heavy heart. Just slow down and listen. Well, that's one way we can help our suffering friends. But what I really wanted to do today was try to pull out some principles about what we can learn from getting back up from Job. How did he do it? How did he go from day to day through this? We know that at the end, everything was restored back to Job. But the Bible doesn't give you a calendar of events. There's no timetable that says, oh, next spring, the boils went away. You know, or next spring, he was able to plant a crop, and in the fall, a harvest came. It doesn't give you any of that. We know that at the end, everything was restored, including children. Well, that didn't happen in a week. That was a long, long time. So stick with us here. How did he get back up through all this? Well, the first idea I want you to get is that he kept his grip on God. Now, his first words recorded were these: naked I came from my mother's womb, and naked I will depart. The Lord has given, and the Lord has taken away. May the name of the Lord be praised. And then this caption from whoever wrote the book of Job says, in all this, Job did not sin by charging God with wrongdoing. I don't know how a guy can say that under those circumstances, but he did. In our college days, Deb and I occasionally visited a small church in Newport, Kentucky, across the river from Cincinnati. Our friend was a minister there, but the former minister came every Sunday. And his name, I am not making this up, his name was Harry Curl. Harry Curl. His mom and dad must have had a great sense. Harry Curl was his name. And Harry suffered from a stroke. And his speech was slow and it was slurred. And when he walked down the church aisles, you would swear that the next step he was going to tip over. I mean, he was leaning and you wondered. But when you greeted him, it was well worth it. Because he would say, hey, Mike, I love you. It took that long. And then he said, hey, Mike, Jesus loves you too. It was excruciating to get those lines out. But man, that was such a cool thing. It's like, that was the highlight of church, was talking with Harry Curl. And he lost everything. He lost everything. His job, his income, his way of life, his physical abilities, his mind. But somehow he kept his grip on God. You got hard days ahead of you. Hold on tight to him. And then this idea, as I read Job, how trouble takes your faith to a deeper level. Think about it. You have tools in your basement and garage that are waiting for trouble, waiting to fix something. Something's going to break down and you're going to be able to go to your garage or basement, find the thing that you need. Girls, that's why they keep all that stuff around for just a moment like this. And then they're able to apply that tool to the problem. Well, faith needs to be the biggest tool in your toolbox of life. And you will use that when you need it. Some days on horrible days, some days on easy days. But, I mean, think about it. You wouldn't know how to use a plunger unless you had trouble somewhere in your house, right? But when it happens, you know you can go grab that thing and use it because you've used it before. Probably most of you have used that before. You know that. And faith is like that. You go and grab it and use it in a case like this. A member of the team that I went to recently with in Kenya was very apprehensive before the trip. This was her first time to fly. She was from a small town in the Midwest. She was traveling alone. She didn't know anybody in the group. And she was carrying money from her church family to help with the project that we were working on. She was nervous. So we talked. And what do you say to a kid like this? I said, Jenna, all the stuff that you've learned about God in children's church and VBS and camp and conferences and from the sermons on Sunday and the song, all that stuff about God is true. The thing is, it's right now just kind of like a theory in your mind. You've maybe never really had to step out there and actually trust God. But it's all true. He is worthy of your trust. You'll see. Just trust him and go for it. None of us want to be there because it's very uncomfortable. None of us want to lose everything like Job did. But when you get clear out to the end of the horizon, you will find that God is there and his right hand will hold you fast. That's what it says in Psalm 139. Remember that movie from Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade? I hope you remember that. Indiana Jones is trying to find the Holy Grail, and he has figured out the clues and he's following the clues, and he comes to this deep, steep canyon. And he's thinking, oh my goodness, I've come this far, but there's no way I can get across this. And he realizes from understanding the formula that there's a walkway there, it's just invisible. And so he steps out into air. It's just air. And his foot lands on something. And he reaches down and picks up some pebbles and dust and throws out there. Lo and behold, the dust and pebbles are standing on a sidewalk kind of thing, a bridge that gets him across the canyon. Faith is like that, not visible, but it's there. Job was miserable and uncomfortable and scared, but the invisible God met him in the darkness, just like he met my friend on her way to Kenya. She turned out to be a star because she was so excited about this adventure that she was on. Trouble takes your faith to a deeper level. And then Job didn't blame God. He just brought his case to God. We know the rest of the story, and we know that God did not cause Job's problems. But God was big enough to let Job complain, and he was gracious enough not to knock Job's head off when he did complain. Somehow he was able to accept that. Mrs. Job said, "Buddy, you need to curse God and die." And we can all understand, what mom could bear losing 10 children on one day? Horrible. But Job asked her a question for the ages. It's not the question that you want, but it's the right question. Shall we accept good from God and not trouble? Wow. I will just state this to you straight up. I believe that I am one of the most blessed men who ever walked the face of the earth in the history of the earth. I believe that. I have been protected. We have been blessed and taken care of. God has met every need and way more than that. Shall I accept good from God and not trouble? Thank you to the church family for helping, for allowing us to be away last week. Deb and I were able to spend a week with our son Caleb and his wife Katie and their new baby Betty up in Maine. And it was so much fun to play with little Betty because she's crawling now. And you helped us pray for her last September. Betty pulled a sneaky one on everybody because she was supposed to come in November, but she decided to come in September. And she came in weighing 3 pounds and 4 ounces, so she spent the first 48 days of her life in the ICU. And a lot of you have been there. You can imagine the stress. The last thing that any parent wants to do is leave their child overnight in the hospital. That's just not a good place to be. But they live close to the hospital. Kate needed to get her own rest and recovery. The baby was under great care. But what a chaotic time. Every day there was a new report, a new development. I asked Caleb, how did you guys do that? 48 days of that. And he said, well, it was just like there were little goals, get some weight, get up to 4 pounds. Remove the feeding tube eventually. Those little victories. But he says mainly it was just to survive the day. Just survive the day. And for the family far away, it's like, what can we do? 2,500 miles away. I will admit to you that I was almost numb to the stuff that was happening here. I mean, you guys would tell me something, I'd go, okay. But really, my brain was out there thinking about them and what we could do to help. And shall we accept good from God and not trouble? A lot of times you've asked this question or it's been asked of you. How can you believe in a loving God when there's so much suffering in this world? Or if you've seen what my eyes have seen, you would never put faith in God. You would never trust God. The answer Job gives is not the answer we want, but it's the answer. Shall we accept good from God and not trouble? Deb and I were able to play with little Betty and crawl on the floor with her and read her some books and rock her to sleep. And I will tell you that there were a couple moments there where I could barely talk. It was like there was a grapefruit in my throat because I knew that I had in my hands evidence of God's faith. Goosebumps even now, even though it's 118 degrees in here. I still got the goosebumps. A friend of mine told me about the capture of the city of Mosul by ISIS troops back a couple years ago. And they have held that city captive and had just committed unspeakable horrors. And finally, that city was liberated by Iraqi troops. And they pushed them out after a long, horrible battle. And ever so slowly, the citizens of Mosul started to emerge. And they had endured so much terror, and they were at all lost weight and barely survived, but they were coming out of the ruins, and they were overjoyed that they were being liberated, that they survived. And then a horrible thing happened. The men were singled out. And they were accused by their liberators of being cowards, and they should have resisted more. They should have escaped and come to the other side and fought against the enemy to liberate their own city. They were accused of collaborating with the enemy. And so some of the men, without a trial, were shot dead on the spot, and their bodies were thrown off a cliff nearby. What? How do you explain any of that? Sometimes when I hear stuff like that, I don't know whether to shake my head in disbelief or scratch and pull my hair out in confusion. Like, how can that happen? I sometimes just go to a song by a classmate of Devin Mines named Rich Mullins, the late Rich Mullins. He wrote, "Sometimes my life just don't make sense at all. When the mountains look so high and my faith seems so small. So hold me, Jesus, because I'm shaking like a leaf. You have been my King of glory. Won't you be my Prince of peace?" So the answer that Job gave to his wife is not the answer you want to hear, but it is the answer. Shall we accept good from God and not trouble? I would recommend highly to you a book called The Insanity of God. I don't like the book, but I recommend it to you because it'll kick your tail about complaining about anything. Because God, in that book, it's documented how God uses trouble, even martyrdom of his people, to advance his kingdom and accomplish his work. It's insane, but it is the way of God. One last point. God is bigger. Sorry, that's my Bowers theology there. It's not, you probably won't read that in a book, but God is bigger. I know it's not very profound, but God listened to Job and his friends talk and make theory about all these events for 37 chapters. And then God broke his silence in chapter 38 through chapter 42. Mostly that's God's answer back to the issue. And God does not address Job's case. He doesn't say anything about stop your complaining, quit your whining. He doesn't say your problems are small. In my simple way, I just say, God would say, I'm bigger, and I got this. So I would like to read to you from The Message some questions of God to Job and his buddies. Where were you when I created the earth? Tell me, since you know so much. Who decided on its size? Certainly you know that. Who came up with the blueprints and the measurements? How was its foundations poured, and who set the cornerstone? While the morning stars sang in chorus and all the angels shouted in praise. And who took charge of the ocean when it gushed forth like a baby from the womb? That was me. I wrapped it in soft clouds and tucked it in safely at night. Then I made a playpen for it, a strong playpen so it couldn't run loose, and said, "Stay here. This is your place. Your wild tantrums are confined to this place." And have you ever ordered the morning, get up, or told the dawn, go to work? Do you know the first thing about death? Do you have one clue regarding death's dark mysteries? And do you have any idea how large the earth is? Speak up if you even have the beginning of an answer. Do you know where light comes from and where darkness lives, so you can take them by the hand and lead them home when they get lost? Why, of course you know that. You've known them all your life. You've grown up in the same neighborhood with them. Have you ever traveled to where the snow's made? seen the vault where hail is stockpiled, the arsenal of hail and snow that I have kept in readiness for times of trouble and battle and war? Can you find your way to where lightning is launched or to the place from which the wind blows? I got nothing. I got nothing. There are four chapters of questions like this, questions for which the smartest scientist would have but a feeble answer. God is saying, I'm bigger. Bigger than your understanding, bigger than these issues. I'm bigger and I've got you. How do you get back up from this? My friend David Drake taught me this, and I have shared it a couple times. I would like to share it with you one more time. He says most of man's problems can be summed up as him having too low a view of God and too high a view of himself. I think so. Job came away from this darkness with a higher view of God. And I hope that's what will happen as you experience these hard things. I would recommend to you some Psalms to read when it hits you, and it will. The Word of God tells you how big God is and how much He values you. It's just so cool to read it. Psalm 139, Psalm 103, Psalm 121 are just a place to start if you're there today. Man, read one of those and let it talk to you. But we need to close, and I need to invite the worship team up. And I just want to just ask you, in a room like this, probably there's some of us who have too low a view of God and too high a view of ourselves. And today, I would just encourage you to take a step back and look at God who is almighty, the God who is undefeated, the God who is bigger than whatever it is you are dealing with today. It really isn't your fight. He loves you, and He's got you. All you have to do is just surrender to Him and try to go day by day. If you need to make a decision for Christ, now's the time to do that.